I think we're about to get started. Welcome everyone to this panel on stopping U.S.-sponsored Israeli terror in Palestine and Lebanon. We have some wonderful speakers here with us tonight. The first speaker will be Mark Hage from Vermonters for a Just Peace in Israel and Palestine. Our second speaker will be Ashley Smith from the International Socialist Organization. And our final speaker will be Mark Estrin, who is also from Vermonters for a Just Peace in Israel and Palestine. And I would encourage people to rally and march this Saturday in City Hall Park starting at 11 o'clock, protest Israel's actions and U.S. funding for Israel's invasion in Lebanon and in Palestine. I think that having this panel and having a protest at this moment is absolutely urgent. There are over 1,000 people dead in Lebanon, and a quarter of the Lebanese population is now refugees, been kicked out of their homes. And Israel today just announced that they want to expand their incursion to more to the north, so they even want to do more of this, which would mean more targeting of civilians, as well as more destruction of civilian infrastructure. So more gas stations, more media outlets, more mosques, more churches, more apartment buildings like the one in Khana. And it's essential, too, that we join the millions of people around the world who are protesting Israel's actions right now. I just want people to get a sense that this is something much larger, you know, than us right here, because there have been huge protests in London, across Europe, protests in Jordan. 100,000 people marched in Sadr City in Iraq this week.
Montreal,
and here in the United States, thousands of people, 60,000 actually just said in Montreal, thousands of people in New York a couple of weeks ago, in the suburb of Dearborn outside of Detroit, there are marches every day of about 1,500 people, so there's, you know, a very strong Middle Eastern population there. And it's also really essential, I think, that we protest here in the United States, given the fact that this is as much the United States war as it is Israel's. In addition to funding Israel to the tune of $5 billion a year, Bush just expedited a new supply of laser-guided missiles to Israel, and he donated $150 million worth of aviation fuel, which is used to drop bombs, in case people, you know, didn't realize that. And the war is very much part of the U.S.'s goal in the Middle East, its overall strategy, which is to crush any resistance to U.S. policy and Israel's policy. And that means resistance in Iraq, means resistance anywhere else it crops up. And the U.S. has gone out of its way to play up the links between Hezbollah and Syria and Iran in order to justify further military action whenever it seems fit. And I think it's also tried to use this Israel's invasion of Lebanon in order to say that anytime you call anything terrorism, that justifies any kind of military response, regardless of how many civilians it kills, even if it means blowing an entire country back to the Stone Ages. And so it's important that we talk about this, it's important that we protest, because also the media has followed suit, I think, with the American government. I mean, the portrayal of Hezbollah as simply a terrorist organization, when in fact it's not a terrorist organization, it's a political organization and a service organization that is actually standing up to Israel and has 87% support of the Lebanese population. So I think we need to keep talking about these issues, what Hezbollah looks like, also what the destruction of Lebanon looks like. And so I think we want to have a good discussion about this. We want to flesh out these issues. There are lots of questions people have, and I think we also really need to talk about where to go from here. And that's what the rally will be about on Saturday, but we have to continue and move forward to that. To Mark Hage, thank you.
Thank you. Well, good evening. As a way of preface, I became active in the Palestine Solidarity Movement in 1982. I was living in San Francisco, and at that time, the city of Beirut, as well as other parts of Lebanon, were being savagely bombed. Mm-hmm. Beirut was literally pummeled for months by Israeli fighter aircraft, artillery units, and naval gunships. And I have this vivid image of sitting on the grass in some lovely park in San Francisco on an exquisitely beautiful California day, and in a U.S. fighter jet flew over. And as it flew over me, I realized that that was exactly the kind of jet. Excuse me. I realized that was exactly the kind of jet that was destroying the capital of Lebanon, which is my father's family's homeland. And it was at that point in my life that I realized that I had to make a choice, and I had to stand up, and I had to do something. I began researching and studying and eventually becoming active in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. I want to open my formal remarks tonight with the words of Moshe Dayan, the infamous Israeli military leader, politician, and some would argue statesman, who was once asked his opinion on the fueling of Israel's appetite for Arab land and for armed confrontation with its Arab neighbors. And this is what he had to say. Israel must see the sword as the main, if not the only, instrument with which to keep its morale high and to retain its moral tension. Toward this end, it must invent dangers. And to do this, it must adopt the method of provocation and revenge. And above all, let us hope for a new war with the Arab countries, so that we may finally get rid of our troubles and acquire our space. End quote. Now, he uttered that opinion in 1955, roughly 1 year before Israel colluded with Great Britain and France to invade Egypt. Now, the notion of provocation and revenge and perpetual war as instruments of state policy is grounded in what I would call a perverse mathematical logic of imperialism and occupation. And I want to borrow now from the thinking of Gilad Atzmon. He's a novelist and a jazz musician. He makes his home in Europe today, but he's a former Israeli citizen, and he's a former Israeli soldier. In an article in Counterpunch on July 22nd, he laid out his theory of what he calls Israel's new math. Two Israeli soldiers, he said, captured by Hezbollah equal the suffering of 500,000 innocent Lebanese civilians displaced from their villages and their homes. 2 = 500,000. The new Israeli math. Mm-hmm. Now, that was on July 22nd. Let's update the math. 2 Israeli soldiers now equal 800,000 to 1 million displaced Lebanese citizens. The destruction of Lebanon's infrastructure and its civil society and the leveling of entire villages in the south of Lebanon and entire neighborhoods in Beirut and Tyre and other cities. 2 = 800,000. Now, we know this war is not about 2 captured Israeli soldiers. Not about that in the least. But Atzmon has a very important point. He goes on to say, more than anything, it is the Hezbollah that made Israel reveal its very devastating notion of blood arithmetic. 2 = 500,000. For those who fail to understand, people who believe in 2 = 500,000 can easily nuke whomever they consider to be their enemies without the slightest hesitation. 2 = 500,000 is there to suggest that Israel isn't just a regional danger. It is the biggest threat to world peace. This is something I've known for a while, but now, thanks to Hezbollah, this will become common knowledge. Bearing witness to the destruction of Lebanon leads one to agree with Michel Lortowski, a longtime Israeli Jewish activist and anti-Zionist, who wrote in his book, The Open Tomb, Israel is a country that, quote, no longer recognizes any moral or geographical boundaries, end quote. Well, that's true enough. But for those of us who have been monitoring and analyzing and protesting Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, their enemies without the slightest hesitation, 2 = 500,000 is there to suggest that Israel isn't just a regional danger. It is the biggest threat to world peace. This is something I've known for a while, but now, thanks to Hezbollah, this will become common knowledge. Bearing witness to the destruction of Lebanon leads one to agree with Michel Lortowski, a longtime Israeli Jewish activist and anti-Zionist, who wrote in his book, The Open Tomb, Israel is a country that, quote, no longer recognizes any moral or geographical boundaries, end quote. Well, that's true enough. But for those of us who have been monitoring and analyzing and protesting Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and I should add the Golan Heights, the forgotten occupation of Syria, the idea of moral and geographical boundaries as they relate to Israel long ago ceased to be an idea that had any relevance. Israel's blood arithmetic is very old news. And in fact, it's more than old news. It is the driving political, military, and racial imperative at the heart of Zionism. The state of Israel, its occupation of Palestine, and its destruction of Lebanon are not possible without the calculus of blood arithmetic and the savage racism that is at its core. Mm-hmm. Blood Arithmetic, 1948. The creation of a Jewish sovereign state in Palestine, a state of, for, and by Jews, no matter where they reside on the planet, equals the forced exodus of 800,000 Palestinians. The destruction of between 400 and 500 Palestinian villages and towns, the ethnic cleansing of entire neighborhoods in major cities in Palestine inhabited by Palestinian Arabs. Blood Arithmetic, 1967, the conquest of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza equals the exile of another 300,000 Palestinians, the imposition of a military occupation that will soon begin its fifth decade, and a colonial settler enterprise that has transferred 400,000 illegal Jewish settlers to the West Bank and East Jerusalem in strict contravention of international law. Mm-hmm. Now let me ground the concept of blood arithmetic in less sweeping terms. In the last 6 years, Israel has killed conservatively 4,100 Palestinians. More than 700 of the victims were children. They asked an Israeli woman activist what she thought of the practice of killing children. Was it a policy, they asked her, or was it just a mistake? Because you understand, they never shoot children on purpose. None of those 700 children were killed deliberately. They're always in the way. And so they asked her. And she said, well, you kill two kids. You kill three kids. Maybe that's an accident. You kill hundreds of kids. It's a policy. Mm-hmm. 31,000 Palestinians have been injured in the last 5 years. Most of them from the use of live ammunition. Right now in Gaza, in the occupied territory from the month of July through the first week of August, Israeli troops killed 182 Palestinians and wounded more than 500. Most of them were killed in Gaza, where Israeli armed forces are pursuing a scorched earth policy, like the one in Lebanon. And like the one in Lebanon, it was planned long before an Israeli soldier was captured. Mm-hmm. Right now, Gaza is also bearing witness to the death of 1 in 3 infants in Gaza hospitals from a lack of access to proper medical care. And I want to repeat this statistic, and I want you to reflect on it for a moment. 1 in 3 Palestinian babies are dying right now, according to UNICEF, in Gazan hospitals because Gazan doctors and nurses and medical personnel cannot care for them adequately. They don't have the medicine, they don't have the food, they don't have the energy. 1 in 3. Condoleezza Rice has nothing to say on that subject, does she? Nor George Bush, nor in fact most of the international community or the American press. What if 1 in 3 Jewish babies were dying in Tel Aviv because Palestinian resistance fighters blocked access to medical care? Do you think Anderson Cooper might find his way to the hospital in Tel Aviv? Or Bob Schieffer? Or Paul Azam? Do you think we might know about it? Let me turn to Hebron. Gideon Levy, some of you may know of his work. He's a former aide to Shimon Peres, the Prime Minister of Israel. He is also now probably one of the best, most compassionate and outraged voices in the Israeli press against the occupation. And in September of 2005, he published an article in Haaretz, Israel's liberal daily newspaper, on the ethnic cleansing of Arab neighborhoods in Hebron. This ethnic cleansing was occurring during the time Israel was carrying out its so-called disengagement from Gaza. So keep this in mind. There are more than 900 international journalists who descend on Gaza to watch this charade play out, the so-called disengagement in Gaza. Here's what's been happening in Hebron for more than 5 years prior to that. It's a bit difficult to believe that the reality in Hebron is hidden from the eyes of most Israelis and is not rocking Israel to its very core. During the past 5 years, some 25,000 Palestinian residents of Hebron have been transferred from their homes, less than an hour's drive from Israel's capital. And daily harassment continues under the auspices of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and Israeli police, disregarded by the media. This harassment is aimed at expelling the remaining Palestinian residents from an area that until recently had a population of about 35,000 Palestinians and 500 Jews. Those who have not visited the city in recent years would not believe their eyes. In the territory under Israeli control, they will discover a ghost town, Hundreds of abandoned homes like after a war, dozens of destroyed stores, burned or shuttered, their gates welded closed by settlers, and an all-pervasive silence. According to the unofficial assessments, no more than 10,000 residents remain in the place. The rest have left their homes and property after no longer being able to bear the harassment from the settlers and their children. This is the largest disengagement in recent years. This is the real expulsion. Every day the settlers torment their neighbors here. Every walk to school for a Palestinian child has become a journey of harassment and fear. Every shopping outing is a journey of humiliation. Settler children kicking old women carrying baskets. Settlers sicking their dogs on the elderly. Garbage and feces thrown from the settlers' balconies into the courtyards of Palestinian homes. Junk metal blocking the entrances of their houses. Rocks thrown at any Palestinian passerby. This is the routine of life in the city. This is the routine of life in the city. Hundreds of soldiers, border policemen, and cops witness these actions and stand by idly. Blood arithmetic. The religious fanaticism and privileged status of 500 Jews in Hebron equal the dispossession of 25,000 Palestinians from their homes in just 5 years' time, and the daily torment of 10,000 more who are still clinging desperately to their lives and their property. What is happening in Hebron today is happening to a greater or lesser degree throughout most of the West Bank. As the construction of Israel's separation wall continues, Jewish settlement expansion continues, and the Israeli military sealed plans for the annexation of much of the territory and its resources, especially its prime agricultural lands and water. The horror of Hebron is the horror of Lebanon, which is the unrelenting horror of Gaza and the West Bank, which is the shared, decades-long horror of what was once Arab Palestine. The blood arithmetic of Lebanon in 2006 was conceived and honed in Palestine, and if unchallenged, will not only devour what remains of Arab Palestine, but continue to transgress all moral and geographical borders as resistance to Zionist occupation and militarism and its international backer, the United States, intensifies. Israel has given the Arab people of Palestine and the Arab people of Lebanon the same message. You will submit to a sovereign and imperial Jewish state in alliance with the United States, or you will be killed, maimed, and incarcerated. Your homes, businesses, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, and civil institutions utterly destroyed or rendered useless. Your lands occupied, stolen, and ravaged. You will be crushed and humiliated. You will perish in fire. No one will be spared, not your babies, not your wives and husbands, not your elderly, not your sick. When you raise your arms, we will shoot you. When you try to escape, even after we tell you to leave, we will kill you. When you return to the rubble of your homes to dig out the dead and to save the living, we will shoot you again. When others come to your aid with bread, water, and medicine, we will shoot them as well as you. When you fight back, we will call you terrorists and accuse you of using civilians as human shields. There will be no mercy, no hope, no ceasefire, no negotiations, no conventions of international law, no recognition of Arab sovereignty or the right of self-determination, only blood arithmetic and the unrelenting machinations of imperialism, racism, and empire. Now, as far as Israel and the United States are concerned, there is no legitimate resistance permitted against Zionism or imperialism. Against the calculus of invasion, annihilation, and occupation, there is only the calculus of resistance. And resistance, violent and nonviolent, will continue to mediate Palestine and the Arab world's relationship with Israel as long as the latter insists on defending and expanding Jewish ethnic sovereignty in the region and to collaborating with U.S. imperialism to impose and sustain an unjust, a violent, and an undemocratic order in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Our next speaker will be Ashley Smith.
I don't know how Mark can sit down and say what he just said, because that's testament to an abomination that Israel is conducting in Israel and Palestine right now. In the terms of Human Rights Watch, they describe it as a crime against humanity. That's a neutral observer about what's going on in Palestine and Lebanon. In reality, both the U.S. and Israel are committing premeditated murder in both countries, atrocities and ethnic cleansing. With U.S. bombs and money, Israel is carpet bombing Lebanon and terrorizing Palestinians in Gaza. Israel has deliberately and directly targeted the civilian population of both countries. In their blitzkrieg in Lebanon, they have blown up a UN post. They have blown up countless civilian habitations, especially in Khana, where they murdered 30 women and children, and they've leveled whole cities of southern Lebanon. They have killed, as Kate said, over 1,000, mostly Lebanese civilians, most of them women and children. A third of the people killed have been under the age of 12 years old. They've displaced a quarter of the population of the country of Lebanon. 1 million people have been driven from their homes. They have deliberately blown up the roads, the ports, and the airports to prevent aid to get to the 1 million people who've been displaced. And yesterday, they announced that they would have a shoot-to-kill order on any moving vehicle in southern Lebanon, blowing up people who try and flee, because anybody in southern Lebanon is a Hezbollah fighter, and they will blow them up. And now, Israel's cabinet has announced that it is going to endorse a full-scale invasion up to the Litani River in Lebanon. So the ground war is going to get worse, and this threatens not only war in Lebanon, but war against Syria, against Iran, and a major conflagration in the entire Middle East. Condoleezza Rice called these atrocities and the process we are witnessing the birth pangs of a new Middle East. This makes Orwell's jokes about doublespeak and newspeak seem trivial. She has life and death fundamentally confused. She is like a mad witch doctor, a mad scientist who wants to kill both the mother and the child in the Middle East. But that's nothing new for Condoleezza Rice, who has an oil tanker named after her, if people know. She was the architect and handmaiden of the wars and atrocities in Afghanistan and Iraq. The great lesson that we have learned from the war in Iraq is that the government lies. The corrupt corporate politicians lie. The media lies. Everything about this war is based on lies as well. The U.S. and Israel have used the pretext of Hezbollah kidnapping 2 Israeli soldiers to justify this war. They make it seem like Israel is standing up to terrorism, defending itself against attacks. If their war crimes weren't so barbaric, this would be laughable. In reality, Israel is the aggressor, not Hezbollah, not Hamas in Palestine and Lebanon. Since 1948, Israel has had expansionist aims to enlarge its territory, as Mark so eloquently documented, and has been doing that at a rapid rate ever since then. They drove 700,000, 800,000, as many as 1 million Palestinians from their land in 1948. In 1967, they illegally occupied Gaza and the West Bank. In Lebanon, they invaded and occupied Lebanon from 1982 to 2000. They still occupy Lebanon. The Sheba farms are still under Israeli occupation since that invasion. They hold over 10,000 Arab, Palestinian, and Lebanese prisoners in their gulags all over Israel. In reality, this is David versus Goliath. And in this case, David is the Palestinians, David is the Lebanese, and Goliath is the Israeli military, the fourth largest in the world, with bankroll by the United States to the tune of $5 billion a year. And they're terrorizing the Palestinians and Lebanese. And the Lebanese and Palestinians, to their heroic courage, refuse to take it without standing up and resisting. And their resistance is the resistance of David against Goliath. Katyusha rockets that were produced in 1942 versus Apache helicopters, drones, bombs from the United States with the highest high-tech weaponry. The U.S., in reality, is behind this entire circumstance. It would be a mistake to see this as Israel's war. This was hatched in Washington, D.C., and it is part and parcel of what the U.S. aims to do in the entire Middle East. The U.S. is using Israel as its proxy to carry through its aims in the Middle East. The U.S. calls it their war on terror. It should be called an imperialist war for oil and global domination. Daddy Bush's henchman Lawrence Korb said in the first Gulf War, "If Iraq grew carrots, we wouldn't give a damn." That still stands for all U.S. policy in the Middle East. The U.S. started its war on terror under the pretext of 9/11 to control all the strategic locations of oil and natural gas in Central Asia and especially the Middle East. That's what they were after in Afghanistan and obviously in Iraq. But it's not just about oil in the Middle East. It's also about making sure no other rival power, China, the European Union, Japan, has independent access to the oil and natural gas reserves of the region. Because if somebody did, they could become a rival to the United States. These are the imperial and corporate motives behind the war on terror. To carry it through, they wanted a series of regime changes. Take Iraq down, then do Iran, then do Syria. Install client regimes that would ensure U.S. control over the vital oil reserves. And install regimes like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt, like Jordan, who have had a nod and a wink approval of what the U.S. and Israel are doing in Lebanon right now. To carry that through, it wasn't only enough to install client regimes, they wanted to crush all resistance in the Middle East, physically, or buy it off if they could get away with it, but the people of the Middle East will resist no matter what. Our rulers agreed on this policy, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. This is a bipartisan consensus for the whole policy in the Middle East. They all voted for the Iraq War, and they all are voting for the atrocities in Lebanon right now. But they suffer from imperial hubris, arrogance, the arrogance of empire. They forgot the basic truism that people do not like to be invaded and occupied. They forgot the basic truism that people resist occupation. However messy or politically conservative, the resistance has trapped the United States in Afghanistan and Iraq. The U.S. has laid waste to both of those societies, but it has produced a resistance that is bogging the U.S. down, trapping it in quicksand. That's where Israel comes in. Because the United States has subcontracted the continuing war in the Middle East to its little local sheriff called the State of Israel to go after Hezbollah as a way to go after Iran and Syria. So the U.S. stands behind the entire war. The U.S. is using Israel in this fashion, and it's nothing new. It's been the self-proclaimed role of Israel in the Middle East to be the local cop for the U.S. big bully, the local mobster for the giant mobster called the United States. That's why Noam Chomsky calls Israel the Mideast Sparta, a permanent warring nation that prosecutes the ambitions of the United States in the region. The U.S. gave the green light to Israel to attack Hezbollah and pressure Iran and Syria either to obey or face war. The U.S. gives them the bombs, supports their entire economy, and gives them diplomatic cover for the atrocities. And they wanted to use the Israeli war to rebuild the alliances that were frayed by the war in Iraq. So what they've got is the entire G8, all the big industrial nations, to sign on to the war aims in the Middle East. And Israel has its own ambitions. It's all very happy to invade Lebanon. That's been its historic aim since Ben-Gurion said he thought that the natural border of Israel is the Litani River. This is an old, old ambition. And Israel used it as an opportunity to try and physically eliminate, along with U.S. sanctions, the government of Hamas in Palestine. However, the U.S. and Israel made the same mistake they made in Iraq. They underestimated the reality of resistance in Lebanon. The Lebanese resistance has fought heroically against the invasion. Israel's response to the heroic resistance is more brutality. And this brutality in Qana, the UN post, the bombing and carpet bombing and destruction of southern Lebanon has exposed the real nature of Israel to the entire, this is 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. To the entire world. And made people identify with Arabs and Muslims for the first time during the war on terror. It's very clear who the victim is. It's Arabs and Muslims, and people have rallied to their support. And seeing that there's a legitimate nationalist liberation struggle in the form of Hezbollah in Lebanon. So 87% of Lebanese, that includes Shia, Sunni, Christians, identify with the Lebanese resistance. All the Arab world, from Baghdad to Cairo, has marched in support of the resistance in Lebanon. And opposition to Israel in all over the world is growing. That's why Israel is politically losing this war. It's militarily losing this war. Their answer is to up the ante. with U.S. approval, with U.S. money, with increased aid from the United States. They are going to go ahead with the ground invasion, and they are going to use the United Nations to try and get a multinational peacekeeping force, we've seen these peacekeeping forces all around the world, to ratify and enforce Israeli conquest of southern Lebanon. And in this escalated war, the possibility of giant conflagration in the Middle East is on the table. And it's all about oil and empire and U.S. domination of the region. The so-called opposition party and opposition politicians in D.C. have behaved disgracefully. Leading Democrats like Hillary Clinton are baying for Arab blood on the streets of New York City in pro-Israel rallies. Our congressional delegation, Leahy, Jeffords, and Sanders, all voted for the strangulation of Palestine and the attack on Lebanon. The entire Democratic Party, without exception, in the U.S. Senate, voted for these atrocities. These people have blood on their hands. Our congressional delegation has blood on its hands. They should have done what Hugo Chavez from Venezuela did today, and that is suspend all relations between Venezuela and the State of Israel. That's what our congressional delegation should have done. Even many in the anti-war movement have been confused and have hesitated, not known how to respond. And we have to say that the position that lots of forces in the mainstream anti-war movement have taken, that there are two sides and the people are caught in the middle, is completely wrong. This is David versus Goliath. If you don't stand with David, what planet are you on? The legitimate resistance must be supported by people in the United States. We've also got no call for a national anti-war demonstration. In London, they had 100,000 people on Saturday. Where is our demonstration? We need a demonstration that connects all the dots. Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and says U.S. out of the Middle East. Our anti-war movement should be doing that. And about the resistance, what's the big deal? Were Native Americans right to oppose European conquest of the United States? Rise up and resist it. Of course they were right. Were the American revolutionists right to kick the Britain, my wife's from Britain, kick Britain out of the United States? What would become the, of course, were the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto right to rise up against Nazi tyranny and murder? Absolutely. The Algerians were right to rise up against French colonialism. The Vietnamese were right to rise up against U.S. domination of Southeast Asia. Whatever disagreements we have with Hezbollah, and as a socialist, I have many disagreements with Hezbollah, but I know that they are the legitimate national liberation struggle of Lebanon. They are not a terrorist organization. They are a mass movement of the downtrodden and the oppressed. But the anti-war movement need not take a position on the resistance to call a demonstration. You don't have to be in support of Hezbollah as a movement, but we should be in the streets protesting and demanding an immediate end to the Israeli war, the immediate withdrawal of all foreign troops from Lebanon. The reason why our anti-war movement is paralyzed and not responded is an orientation on the Democratic Party. This is a party of war. It has endorsed the entire project, and we have to say that that's got to go as a strategy. You can't vote for Hillary Clinton to oppose war. You can't vote for John Kerry. You can't vote for the heart of the Democratic Party, which is committed to these wars and atrocities. We must transform and rebuild the anti-war movement to oppose both the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and its proxy war on Lebanon and Palestine. The left in the anti-war movement has long argued that this was essential. There was no way to oppose the U.S. war in Iraq without opposing the U.S. support for the occupation of Palestine. These are the two beachheads for U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. You cannot oppose one without opposing the other. We were right to argue that. Now it's a bridge that we have to cross as a movement. We have to come out against all the occupations and see them as part of the project of U.S. imperial domination of the region. That means U.S. out of Iraq, Israel out of Palestine, Israel out of Lebanon, preventing U.S. war on Syria and Iran. U.S. out of the Middle East has to be our demand. And we also have to reach out to the Arabs and Muslims that are in the streets for the first time since the massacre in Jenin. We are talking about thousands and thousands of Arabs and Muslims who are marching all around the world and in the United States. We have to link arms and see it's a common struggle. And to do that effectively, we have to be independent from the two corporate parties. We, the anti-war movement, in solidarity with the people of the Middle East, have to set our own agenda. And we have a tremendous opportunity to do that. 46% of people disapprove of Bush's war on Lebanon. 43% approve of it. We have a majority, plurality, I don't know the technicality. More people are on our side. 60% oppose the war on Iraq. There is swelling discontent against business as usual in our society. The task of the anti-war activists right now is to draw on that growing opposition, use it politically, and get it back in the streets so we can really build an anti-war movement that ends U.S. and Israeli terror in the Middle East and fight for a different kind of society that's not about oil, empire, and profit, but puts human need and solidarity with the people of the earth first and foremost as the bedrock of our society.
Thank you, Ashley. That was great. Our next speaker will be Mark Estrin from Vermonters for Just Peace in Israel and Palestine.
I'd like to talk a little bit to the side of these very eloquent frontal attacks to fill out the space around it. Ashley talked about the congressional votes, and I think it would be very, very good for you to read the text of the bills and resolutions that were voted for by our congressional delegation. And I don't want to take your time with them, but I do want to give you the numbers of them so you can Google these things and read them. You won't have to buy the next Stephen King novel. H.R. 4681 is the Palestinian Terrorist Act. In which the US and Bernie condemned the election in Palestine as having put in place a terrorist organization and then demanded no cooperation and blockage of this organization. Two acts, one is HRES 921, and the next day was the Senate Res 534. Just write those numbers down, Google them, and you will find the resolutions that were passed unanimously by the Senate. Now, this was a voice vote, and in fact, I don't know if Leahy and Jeffords were in there saying aye. And I haven't been able to find that out because it's not recorded, each person who voted. If anybody knows, I do know that they haven't come out with any commentary that would indicate that they did not support it. And also Bernie's vote for a similar bill. And basically what those do is say quite clearly that it's Hamas and Hezbollah that are to blame for starting unprovoked attacks, and that, of course, they defend Israel's right to defend itself. They demand sanctions on Syria and Iran, right? And this is the one I like best. They commend the President of the United States for fully supporting Israel, quote unquote. Take a look at them. It's great reading. These are morally disgusting acts in themselves, but I want to point out one thing, which is the illegality of voting for such things, so that not only are Jeffords, Leahy, and Sanders problematical in their positions, but they're criminals for voting for this. Section 4 of the U.S. Arms Export Control Act requires, quote, that military items transferred to foreign governments by the United States be used solely for internal security and legitimate self-defense. Therefore, all the weapons that we're giving, that Israel is doing the war with, have been transferred illegally. And the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, with some amendments, currently prohibits, quote, any assistance at all to nations which engage in torture or systematic violation of human rights. These two acts are being ignored by our congressional delegation, and ignoring them is a federal felony crime. It's as if Union Carbide were to sell chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein. We wouldn't go with that. So the first question that I have is, how do we understand these moves on the part of our delegation? I want to come back to Burlington, in fact, to the street corner of Church Street and Pearl Street. About 3 weeks ago, there was one of the weekly demonstrations, and I believe Kathleen was afterwards speaking and noting the ratio of deaths between Israelis, which, by the way, most Israeli deaths are soldiers, and their victims, which are almost entirely civilians. So Kathleen said something like, is that what we're supposed to support? Is one Israeli life worth 10 Lebanese or Palestinian ones? That's the ratio. It's been pretty constant in Lebanon. A guy in the crowd said, it is. He was then hustled off, and the incident almost became violent, but I was really perplexed because I didn't know what to say. If he wasn't hustled off, what would I say besides hustling him off? So this leaves me perplexed, and I think we need to understand how someone could say that, or you know what Mark was talking about, the Israeli math, the blood math. And by the way, it is, I want to give you the ultimate quote about that. You may remember that in 1994, a doctor, a Jewish settler named Baruch Goldstein, massacred 27 Palestinians who were praying in a mosque in Hebron. At his funeral, and he was killed. He machine gunned 27 people. At his funeral, a rabbi named Yaakov Perin made a eulogy for Baruch Goldstein. And this is what he said. It's easy to remember. It's worth remembering. 1 million Arabs, he said, are not worth a Jewish fingernail. Now, that goes beyond both the numbers. Mark only got to 800,000, right? But it indicates something, the fingernail part of it especially, indicates something that's quite different from any kind of realpolitik. Again, left me confused. The third thing that leaves me confused annually is today. Today is, as you probably know, Nagasaki Day. And whatever the phony justifications for bombing Hiroshima, oh, we're going to save lives, etc., etc., there were no justifications at all for dropping a second bomb 3 days later. And there's something going on in the psychology of people who do that I finally still don't understand. But I want to hopefully throw out a couple of theories and ask that we can discuss this a little. Why are there no congressional objections? Why Nagasaki? Why the rabbi and the man in the crowd? Now, if it's politicians, you might just say, okay, they're pandering to AIPAC or others, they want their votes. But Bernie has shown consistent moral blindness throughout the years about these issues. He didn't have to pander for votes for a long time. Something else is going on. So here's one thing that came up the other day, and it was an article that showed up on ZNet, and I really recommend it. It was new. It was a new thought for me. And I want to read you just a little bit of this article. It's an article that's called Israel as a Future of the Globe by Satya Sagar, S-A-G-A-R, and I would, again, urge you to Google Sagar. And this is what he says. For all those who think that Israel is run by the most despicable, racist, and repressive regime in the world, there is some very bad news indeed. Not only are the Israeli state and its ruthless methods here to stay, they could also be a prototype of our collective global nature. Watching the unbelievable destruction wrought by the Israelis in Gaza and Lebanon, a simple question very high on many minds must be, how in hell does this artificially concocted child of European guilt and American ambition get away with all of this again and again and again? The answer is that instead of being a strange historical aberration, Israel may well be a model state that global elites want to establish to control the world in the days to come. A world where the ruling classes live off the stolen resources and labor of those that they contemptuously deem lesser human beings, in a system of institutionalized apartheid. A world where the forces of militarized state can routinely shoot anybody, even entire populations, and call them terrorists with complete impunity. A world where the process of nation building automatically involves smashing the sovereignty of every nation, reducing their people to a faceless, nameless, helpless mass. Now imagine that, bringing birth to and legitimizing a new role model. Condoleezza is almost right. It's the birth pangs of a new role model. So let me just skip a little bit. There's clearly racism involved in this, but I want to suggest two other dimensions. And one is something that Rudolf Steiner called the loss of the sense of the personhood of the other. The loss of the sense of the personhood of the other. Steiner says, of course, we have more than five senses. Temperature sense, for instance. But one of the senses that we have is a very deep understanding that another person is, in fact, a person. Right? And when we lose that, it does go far to explain a lot of the actions. Now, you know, I watch my cat, Hester. She doesn't see... I held up a big photograph of a cat, of her. At her, it's about this big, the other day. She doesn't see it. She doesn't see pictures of cats. She doesn't see pictures of birds. Like, get out of my face. I want to. On the other hand, a cat, you know, 50 yards across the yard, she's on it. Hester doesn't see representations of others, but I would suggest that we see only representations of others. And we don't see others. We've lost the sense of seeing others. A favorite author of mine, Nathaniel Hawthorne, I'd like to end with this little Hawthorne bit, is that there's a story, a Hawthorne story, that's called Earth's Holocaust. This is 1840s. It's not often anthologized, you may see why. There's a huge bonfire that's been built. Once upon a time, he says, the inhabitants of the world determined to rid themselves of the evil accumulation of worn-out trumpery by heaving it all into an enormous bonfire. It's interesting what the list of things that people want to get rid of to get rid of evil. Coats of armor, scepters of kings, hogsheads of liquor, banknotes, sonnets, diplomas, weapons, machinery to inflict the punishment of death, marriage certificates, ledgers, statute books, and printed paper in general, priestly garments, and the Bible. All of these things are thrown into this bonfire in order to get rid of evil. And as the fire is burning down, and the reformers are leaving to go to bed, a man with flaming red eyes appears, and he talks to a small band, and this is what he says. There's one thing that these wiseacres have forgotten to throw into the fire, and with which all the rest of the conflagration is just nothing at all. Yes, though they had burned the earth itself into a cinder. And what may that be? Eagerly demanded the last murderer on earth. What but the human heart itself? Demanded the dark-visaged stranger with a portentous grin. And unless they hit upon some method of purifying that foul cavern, forth from it will reissue all the shapes of wrong and misery, the same shapes or worse ones which they have taken such a vast deal of trouble to consume to ashes. Einstein said that three great powers ruled the world: stupidity, fear, and greed. Three great powers. They all seat themselves in the foul cavern, the human heart, and they build their institutions upon them. To move on from here, we're going to have to address both the institutions and the foul cavern. Thank you.
Thank you to all the panelists. That was wonderful and very informative, and I think shows the need that we organize against Israel's actions in Lebanon and in Palestine. Protest.